Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig. Copyright 1974 by Robert M. Pirsig. This recording of the full-length reading of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance was published by arrangement with Audio Renaissance Tapes and was produced in 1997 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Neither this recording, nor any part thereof, may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authority from Books on Tape Incorporated. This book is read by Michael Kramer. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig. This book consists of four parts in 32 chapters and is 380 pages long. The following material appears in the dust jacket of the book. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. The extraordinary story of a man's quest for truth. It will change the way you think and feel about your life. Dedication. For my family. Special thanks should go to Stuart Cohen, who provided an office to write in, and Mrs. Abigail Kenyon for critical help with the early chapters. Author's note. What follows is based on actual occurrences. Although much has been changed for rhetorical purposes, it must be regarded in its essence as fact. However, it should in no way be associated with that great body of factual information relating to Orthodox Zen Buddhist practice. It's not very factual on motorcycles, either. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And what is good, Phaedrus? And what is not good? Need we ask anyone to tell us these things? Part 1. Chapter 1. I can see by my watch, without taking my hand from the left grip of the cycle, that it is 8:30 in the morning. The wind, even at 60 miles an hour, is warm and humid. When it's this hot and muggy at 8:30, I'm wondering what it's going to be like in the afternoon. In the wind are pungent odors from the marshes by the road. We are in an area of the Central Plains filled with thousands of duck-hunting sloughs, heading northwest from Minneapolis toward the Dakotas. This highway is an old concrete two-laner that hasn't had much traffic since a four-laner went in parallel to it several years ago. When we pass a marsh, the air suddenly becomes cooler. Then, when we are past, it suddenly warms up again. I'm happy to be riding back into this country. It is a kind of nowhere, famous for nothing at all, and has an appeal because of just that. Tensions disappear along old roads like this. We bump along the beat-up concrete between the cattails and stretches of meadow, and then more cattails and marsh grass. Here and there is a stretch of open water, and if you look closely, you can see wild ducks at the edge of the cattails, and turtles. There's a red-winged blackbird. I whack Chris's knee and point to it. What? He hollers. Blackbird! He says something I don't hear. What? I holler back. He grabs the back of my helmet and hollers up. I've seen lots of those, Dad! Oh! I holler back. Then I nod. At age 11, you don't get very impressed with red-winged blackbirds. You have to get older for that. For me, this is all mixed with memories that he doesn't have. Cold mornings long ago when the marsh grass had turned brown and cattails were waving in the northwest wind. The pungent smell then was from muck stirred up by hip boots while we were getting in position for the sun to come up and the duck season to open. Or winters when the sloughs were frozen over and dead and I could walk across the ice and snow between the dead cattails and see nothing but gray skies and dead things and cold. The blackbirds were gone then. But now, in July, they're back, and everything is at its alivest, and every foot of these sloughs is humming and cricking and buzzing and chirping, a whole community of millions of living things living out their lives in a kind of benign continuum. You see things vacationing on a motorcycle in a way that is completely different from any other. In a car, you're always in a compartment, and because you're used to it, you don't realize that through that car window, everything you see is just more TV. You're a passive observer, and it is all moving by you, boringly, in a frame. On a cycle, the frame is gone. You're completely in contact with it all. You're in the scene, not just watching it anymore, and the sense of presence is overwhelming. That concrete whizzing by 5 inches below your foot is the real thing, the same stuff you walk on. It's right there, so blurred you can't focus on it, yet you can put your foot down and touch it any time. And the whole thing, the whole experience, is never removed from immediate consciousness. Chris and I are traveling to Montana with some friends riding up ahead, and maybe headed farther than that. Plans are deliberately indefinite, more to travel than to arrive anywhere. We are just vacationing. Secondary roads are preferred. Paved county roads are the best. State highways are next. Freeways are the worst. We want to make good time, but for us now, this is measured with emphasis on good rather than time. And when you make that shift in emphasis, the whole approach changes. Twisting hilly roads are long in terms of seconds, but are much more enjoyable on a cycle, where you bank into turns and don't get swung from side to side in any compartment. Roads with little traffic are more enjoyable, as well as safer. Roads free of drive-ins and billboards are better. Roads where groves and meadows and orchards and lawns come almost to the shoulder. Where kids wave to you when you ride by. Where people look from their porches to see who it is. Where when you stop to ask directions or information, the answer tends to be longer than you want, rather than short. Where people ask where you're from and how long you've been riding. It was some years ago that my wife and I and our friends first began to catch on to these roads. We took them once in a while for variety, or for a shortcut to another main highway. And each time the scenery was grand, and we left the road with a feeling of relaxation and enjoyment. We did this time after time before realizing what should have been obvious. These roads are truly different from the main ones. The whole pace of life and personality of the people who live along them are different. They're not going anywhere. They're not too busy to be courteous. The here-ness and now-ness of things is something they know all about. It's the others, the ones who moved to the cities years ago, and their lost offspring, who have all but forgotten it. The discovery was a real find. I've wondered why it took us so long to catch on. We saw it, and yet we didn't see it. Or rather, we were trained not to see it. Conned, perhaps, into thinking that the real action was metropolitan, and all this was just boring hinterland. It was a puzzling thing. The truth knocks on the door and you say, "Go away! I'm looking for the truth." And so it goes away. Puzzling. But once we caught on, of course, nothing could keep us off these roads, weekends, evenings, vacations. We have become real secondary road motorcycle buffs, and found there are things you learn as you go. We have learned how to spot the good ones on a map, for example. If the line wiggles, that's good. That means hills. If it appears to be the main route from a town to a city, that's bad. The best ones always connect nowhere with nowhere, and have an alternate that gets you there quicker. If you are going northeast from a large town, you never go straight out of town for any long distance. You go out, and then you start jogging north, then east, then north again. And soon you are on a secondary route that only the local people use. The main skill is to keep from getting lost. Since the roads are used only by local people who know them by sight, nobody complains if the junctions aren't posted, and often they aren't. When they are, it's usually a small sign hiding unobtrusively in the weeds, and that's all. County road sign makers seldom tell you twice. If you miss that sign in the weeds, that's your problem, not theirs. Moreover, you discover that the highway maps are often inaccurate about county roads. And from time to time, you find your county road takes you onto a two-rutter, and then a single-rutter, and then into a pasture and stops. Or else it takes you into some farmer's backyard. So we navigate mostly by dead reckoning and deduction from what clues we find. I keep a compass in one pocket for overcast days when the sun doesn't show directions, and have the map mounted in a special carrier on top of the gas tank, where I can keep track of miles from the last junction and know what to look for. With those tools and a lack of pressure to get somewhere, it works out fine. And we just about have America all to ourselves. On Labor Day and Memorial Day weekends, we travel for miles on these roads without seeing another vehicle, then cross a federal highway and look at cars strung bumper to bumper to the horizon. Scowling faces inside, kids crying in the back seat. I keep wishing there were some way to tell them something, but they scowl and appear to be in a hurry. And there isn't. I have seen these marshes 1,000 times, yet each time they're new. It's wrong to call them benign. You could just as well call them cruel and senseless. They are all of these things, but the reality of them overwhelms halfway conceptions. There. A huge flock of red-winged blackbirds ascends from nests in the cattails, startled by our sound. I swat Chris's knee a second time, then I remember he has seen them before.
What?
He hollers again.
Nothing. Well, what?
Just checking to see if you're still there, I holler, and nothing more is said. Unless you're fond of hollering, you don't make great conversations on a running cycle. Instead, you spend your time being aware of things and meditating on them. On sights and sounds, of the mood of the weather and things remembered, on the machine and the countryside you're in, thinking about things at great leisure and length, without being hurried and without feeling you're losing time. What I would like to do is use the time that is coming now to talk about some things that have come to mind. We're in such a hurry most of the time we never get much chance to talk. The result is a kind of endless day-to-day shallowness, a monotony that leaves a person wondering years later where all the time went and sorry that it's all gone. Now that we do have some time, and know it, I would like to use the time to talk in some depth about things that seem important. What is in mind is a sort of Chautauqua. That's the only name I can think of for it. Like the traveling tent show Chautauquas that used to move across America. This America. The one that we are in now. An old-time series of popular talks intended to edify and entertain, improve the mind, and bring culture and enlightenment to the ears and thoughts of the hearer. The Chautauquas were pushed aside by faster-paced radio, movies, and TV, and it seems to me the change was not entirely an improvement. Perhaps because of these changes, the stream of national consciousness moves faster now and is broader, but it seems to run less deep. The old channels cannot contain it, and in its search for new ones, there seems to be growing havoc and destruction along its banks. In this Chautauqua, I would like not to cut any new channels of consciousness, but simply dig deeper into old ones that have become silted in with the debris of thoughts grown stale and platitudes too often repeated. What's new is an interesting and broadening eternal question, but one which, if pursued exclusively, results only in an endless parade of trivia and fashion, the silt of tomorrow. I would like, instead, to be concerned with the question, what is best? A question which cuts deeply rather than broadly, a question whose answers tend to move the silt downstream. There are eras of human history in which the channels of thought have been too deeply cut, and no change was possible. And nothing new ever happened, and best was a matter of dogma. But that is not the situation now. Now the stream of our common consciousness seems to be obliterating its own banks, losing its central direction and purpose, flooding the lowlands, disconnecting and isolating the highlands, and to no particular purpose other than the wasteful fulfillment of its own internal momentum. Some channel deepening seems called for. Up ahead, the other riders, John Sutherland and his wife Sylvia, have pulled into a roadside picnic area. It's time to stretch. As I pull my machine beside them, Sylvia is taking her helmet off and shaking her hair loose, while John puts his BMW up on the stand. Nothing is said. We have been on so many trips together, we know from a glance how one another feels. Right now, we are just quiet and looking around. The picnic benches are abandoned at this hour of the morning. We have the whole place to ourselves. John goes across the grass to a cast-iron pump and starts pumping water to drink. Chris wanders down through some trees beyond a grassy knoll to a small stream. I am just staring around. After a while, Sylvia sits down on the wooden picnic bench and straightens out her legs, lifting one at a time slowly without looking up. Long silences mean gloom for her, and I comment on it. She looks up and then looks down again.
"It was all those people in the cars coming the other way," she says. "The first one looked so sad. And then the next one looked exactly the same way, and then the next one and the next one. They were all the same.
They were just commuting to work." She perceives well, but there was nothing unnatural about it.
"Well, you know, work,"
I repeat. Monday morning, half asleep. Who goes to work Monday morning with a grin?
It's just that they look so lost, she says. Like they were all dead. Like a funeral procession.
Then she puts both feet down and leaves them there. I see what she is saying, but logically it doesn't go anywhere. You work to live, and that's what they are doing. I am watching swamps, I say. After a while, she looks up and says,
What did you see?
There was a whole flock of red-winged blackbirds. They rose up suddenly when we went by.
Oh.
I was happy to see them again. They tie things together, thoughts and such, you know? She thinks for a while, and then, with the trees behind her a deep green, she smiles. She understands a peculiar language which has nothing to do with what you are saying.
A daughter.
Yes, she says. They're beautiful. Watch for them, I say.
All right.
John appears and checks the gear on the cycle. He adjusts some of the ropes and then opens the saddlebag and starts rummaging through. He sets some things in the ground. If you ever need any rope, don't hesitate, he says. God, I think I've got about 5 times what I need here. Not yet, I answer. Matches, he says, still rummaging. Sunburn lotion, combs, shoelaces. Shoelaces? What do we need shoelaces for?
Let's not start that, Sylvia says.
They look at each other, deadpan, and then both look over at me. Shoelaces can break any time, I say solemnly. They smile, but not at each other. Chris soon appears, and it is time to go. While he gets ready and climbs on, they pull out, and Sylvia waves. We are on the highway again, and I watch them gain distance up ahead. The Chautauqua that is in mind for this trip was inspired by these two many months ago, and perhaps, although I don't know, is related to a certain undercurrent of disharmony between them. Disharmony, I suppose, is common enough in any marriage, but in their case it seems more tragic. To me, anyway. It's not a personality clash between them. It's something else, for which neither is to blame, but for which neither has any solution, and for which I'm not sure I have any solution either, just ideas. The ideas began with what seemed to be a minor difference of opinion between John and me on a matter of small importance, how much one should maintain one's own motorcycle. It seems natural and normal to me to make use of the small toolkits and instruction booklets supplied with each machine, and keep it tuned and adjusted myself. John demurs. He prefers to let a competent mechanic take care of these things so that they are done right. Neither viewpoint is unusual, and this minor difference would never have become magnified if we didn't spend so much time riding together and sitting in country roadhouses drinking beer and talking about whatever comes to mind. What comes to mind, usually, is whatever we've been thinking about in the half hour or 45 minutes since we last talked to each other. When it's roads or weather or people or old memories or what's in the newspapers, the conversation just naturally builds pleasantly. But whenever the performance of the machine has been on my mind and gets into the conversation, the building stops. The conversation no longer moves forward. There is a silence and a break in the continuity. It is as though two old friends, a Catholic and Protestant, were sitting drinking beer, enjoying life, and the subject of birth control somehow came up. Big freeze-out. And of course, when you discover something like that, it's like discovering a tooth with a missing filling. You can never leave it alone. You have to probe it, work around it, push on it, think about it. Not because it's enjoyable, but because it's on your mind, and it won't get off your mind. And the more I probe and push on this subject of cycle maintenance, the more irritated he gets, and of course that makes me want to probe and push all the more. Not deliberately to irritate him, but because the irritation seems symptomatic of something deeper, something under the surface that isn't immediately apparent. When you're talking birth control, what blocks it and freezes it out is that it's not a matter of more or fewer babies being argued. That's just on the surface. What's underneath is a conflict of faith. A faith in empirical social planning versus faith in the authority of God as revealed by the teachings of the Catholic Church. You can prove the practicality of Planned Parenthood till you get tired of listening to yourself. And it's going to go nowhere because your antagonist isn't buying the assumption that anything socially practical is good per se. Goodness for him has other sources which he values as much as, or more, than social practicality. So it is with John. I can preach the practical value and worth of motorcycle maintenance till I'm hoarse, and it would not make a dent in him. After two sentences on the subject, his eyes go completely glassy and he changes the conversation or just looks away. He doesn't want to hear about it. Sylvia is completely with him on this one. In fact, she is even more emphatic. It's just a whole other thing, she says, when in a thoughtful mood. Like garbage, she says, when not. They want not to understand it, not to hear about it. And the more I try to fathom what makes me enjoy mechanical work and them hate it so, the more elusive it becomes. The ultimate cause of this originally minor difference of opinion appears to run way, way deep. Inability on their part is ruled out immediately. They are both plenty bright enough. Either one of them could learn to tune a motorcycle in an hour and a half if they put their minds and energy to it, and the saving in money and worry and delay would repay them over and over again for their effort. And they know that. Or maybe they don't. I don't know. I never confront them with the question. It's better to just get along. But I remember once, outside a bar in Savage, Minnesota, on a really scorching day, when I just about let loose. We'd been in the bar for about an hour, and we came out, and the machines were so hot you could hardly get on them. I'm started and ready to go, and there's John pumping away in the Kickstarter. I smell gas like we're next to a refinery and tell him so, thinking this is enough to let him know his engine's flooded. Yeah, I smell it too, he says, and keeps on pumping. And he pumps and pumps and pumps and pumps, and I don't know what more to say. Finally, he's really winded and sweat's running down all over his face, and he can't pump anymore, and so I suggest taking out the plugs to dry them off and air out the cylinders while we go back for another beer. Oh, my God, no. He doesn't want to get into all that stuff. Oh, what stuff? Oh, getting out the tools and all that stuff. There's no reason why it shouldn't start. It's a brand new machine, and I'm following the instructions perfectly. See, it's right on full choke, like they say. Full choke? That's what the instructions say. That's for when it's cold. Well, we've been in there for a half an hour, at least, he says. It kind of shakes me up. This is a hot day, John, I say. And they take longer than that to cool off, even on a freezing day. He scratches his head. Well, why don't they tell you that in the instructions? He opens the choke, and on the second kick, it starts. I guess that was it, he says cheerfully. And the very next day, we were out near the same area, and it happened again. This time I was determined not to say a word, and when my wife urged me to go over and help him, I shook my head. I told her that until he had a real felt need, he was just going to resent help. So we went over and sat in the shade and waited. I noticed he was being super polite to Sylvia while he pumped away, meaning he was furious, and she was looking over with a kind of ye gods look. If he had asked any single question, I would have been over in a second to diagnose it, but he wouldn't. It must have been 15 minutes before he got it started. Later, we were drinking beer again over at Lake Minnetonka, and everybody was talking around the table, but he was silent, and I could see he was really tied up in knots inside. After all that time, probably to get them untied, he finally said, "You know, when it doesn't start like that, it just really turns me into a monster inside. I just get paranoiac about it." This seemed to loosen him up, and he added, "They just had this one motorcycle, see? This Lemon. And they didn't know what to do with it, whether to send it back to the factory or sell it for scrap or what. And then at the last moment they saw me coming, with $1,800 in my pocket, and they knew their problems were over." In a kind of sing-song voice, I repeated the plea for tuning, and he tried hard to listen. He really tries hard sometimes, but then the block came again, and he was off to the bar for another round for all of us, and the subject was closed. He is not stubborn, not narrow-minded, not lazy, not stupid. There was just no easy explanation. So it was left up in the air, a kind of mystery that one gives up on because there is no sense in just going round and round and round looking for an answer that's not there. It occurred to me that maybe I was the odd one on the subject, but that was disposed of too. Most touring cyclists know how to keep their machines tuned. Car owners usually won't touch the engine, but every town of any size at all has a garage with expensive lifts, special tools, and diagnostic equipment that the average owner can't afford. And a car engine is more complex and inaccessible than a cycle engine, so there's more sense to this. But for John's cycle, a BMW R60, I'll bet there's not a mechanic between here and Salt Lake City. If his points or plugs burn out, he's done for. I know he doesn't have a set of spare points with him. He doesn't know what points are. If it quits on him in western South Dakota or Montana, I don't know what he's going to do. Sell it to the Indians, maybe. Right now, I know what he's doing. He's carefully avoiding giving any thought whatsoever to the subject. The BMW is famous for not giving mechanical problems on the road, and that's what he's counting on. I might have thought this was just a peculiar attitude of theirs about motorcycles, but discovered later that it extended to other things. Waiting for them to get going one morning in their kitchen, I noticed the sink faucet was dripping, and remembered that it was dripping the last time I was there before, and that, in fact, it had been dripping as long as I could remember. I commented on it, and John said he had tried to fix it with a new faucet washer, but it hadn't worked. That was all he said. The presumption left was that that was the end of the matter. If you try to fix a faucet and your fixing doesn't work, then it's just your lot to live with a dripping faucet. This made me wonder to myself if it got on their nerves, this drip, 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 week in, week out, year in, year out. But I could not notice any irritation or concern about it on their part, and so concluded they just aren't bothered by things like dripping faucets. Some people aren't. What it was that changed this conclusion, I don't remember. Some intuition, some insight one day. Perhaps it was a subtle change in Sylvia's mood whenever the dripping was particularly loud and she was trying to talk. She has a very soft voice. And one day, when she was trying to talk about the dripping, and the kids came in and interrupted her, she lost her temper at them. It seemed that her anger at the kids would not have been nearly as great if the faucet hadn't also been dripping when she was trying to talk. It was the combined dripping and loud kids that blew her up. What struck me hard then was that she was not blaming the faucet, and that she was deliberately not blaming the faucet. She wasn't ignoring that faucet at all. She was suppressing anger at that faucet, and that goddamn dripping faucet was just about killing her. But she could not admit the importance of this for some reason. Why suppress anger at a dripping faucet, I wondered. Then that patched in with the motorcycle maintenance, and one of those light bulbs went on over my head, and I thought, ah, it's not the motorcycle maintenance, not the faucet. It's all of technology they can't take. And then all sorts of things started tumbling into place, and I knew that was it. Sylvia's irritation at a friend who thought computer programming was creative. All their drawings and paintings and photographs without a technological thing in them. Of course she's not going to get mad at that faucet, I thought. You always suppress momentary anger at something you deeply and permanently hate. Of course John signs off every time the subject of cycle repair comes up, even when it is obvious he is suffering for it. That's technology. And sure, of course, obviously. It's so simple when you see it. To get away from technology, out into the country, in the fresh air and sunshine, is why they are on the motorcycle in the first place. For me to bring it back to them, just at the point in place where they think they have finally escaped it, just frosts both of them tremendously. That's why the conversation always breaks and freezes when the subject comes up. Other things fit in, too. They talk once in a while, in as few pained words as possible, about it, or it all, as in the sentence, there is just no escape from it. And if I asked from what, the answer might be the whole thing, or the whole organized bit, or even the system. Sylvia once said defensively, well, you know how to cope with it, which puffed me up so much at the time I was embarrassed to ask what it was, and so remained somewhat puzzled. I thought it was something more mysterious than technology, but now I see that the it was mainly, if not entirely, technology. But that doesn't sound right either. The it is a kind of force that gives rise to technology. Something undefined, but inhuman, mechanical, lifeless. A blind monster, a death force. Something hideous they are running from, but know they can never escape. I'm putting it way too heavily here, but in a less emphatic and less defined way, this is what it is. Somewhere, there are people who understand it and run it, but those are technologists, and they speak an inhuman language when describing what they do. It's all parts and relationships of unheard-of things that never make any sense no matter how often you hear about them. And their things, their monster, keeps eating up land and polluting their air and lakes, and there is no way to strike back at it, and hardly any way to escape it. That attitude is not hard to come to. You go through a heavy industrial area of a large city, and there it all is, the technology. In front of it are high barbed wire fences, locked gates, signs saying no trespassing, and beyond, through sooty air, you see ugly, strange shapes of metal and brick whose purpose is unknown and whose masters you will never see. What it's for, you don't know, and why it's there, there's no one to tell. And so all you can feel is alienated, estranged, as though you don't belong there. Who owns and understands this doesn't want you around. All this technology has somehow made you a stranger in your own land. Its very shape and appearance and mysteriousness say, get out. You know there's an explanation for all this somewhere, and what it's doing undoubtedly serves mankind in some indirect way, but that isn't what you see. What you see is the no trespassing, keep out signs, and not anything serving people but little people, like ants, serving these strange, incomprehensible shapes. And you think, even if I were a part of this, even if I were not a stranger, I would just be another ant serving the shapes. So the final feeling is hostile, and I think that's ultimately what's involved with this otherwise unexplainable attitude of John and Sylvia. Anything to do with valves and shafts and wrenches is a part of that dehumanized world, and they would rather not think about it. They don't want to get into it. If this is so, they are not alone. There is no question that they have been following their natural feelings in this and not trying to imitate anyone. But many others are also following their natural feelings and not trying to imitate anyone, and the natural feelings of very many people are similar on this matter. So that when you look at them collectively, as journalists do, you get the illusion of a mass movement, an anti-technological mass movement, an entire political anti-technological left emerging, looming up from apparently nowhere saying, stop the technology, have it somewhere else, don't have it here. It is still restrained by a thin web of logic that points out that without the factories, there are no jobs or standard of living. But there are human forces stronger than logic. There always have been, and if they become strong enough in their hatred of technology, that web can break. Clichés and stereotypes such as beatnik or hippie have been invented for the anti-technologists, the anti-system people, and will continue to be. But one does not convert individuals into mass people with the simple coining of a mass term. John and Sylvia are not mass people, and neither are most of the others going their way. It is against being a mass person that they seem to be revolting, and they feel that technology has got a lot to do with the forces that are trying to turn them into mass people, and they don't like it. So far, it's still mostly a passive resistance, flights into the rural areas when they are possible, and things like that. But it doesn't always have to be this passive. I disagree with them about cycle maintenance, but not because I am out of sympathy with their feelings about technology. I just think that their flight from and hatred of technology is self-defeating. The Buddha, the Godhead, resides quite as comfortably in the circuits of a digital computer or the gears of a cycle transmission as he does at the top of a mountain or in the petals of a flower. To think otherwise is to demean the Buddha, which is to demean oneself. This is what I want to talk about in this Chautauqua. We're out of the marshes now, but the air is still so humid you can look straight up, directly at the yellow circle of the sun as if there were smoke or smog in the sky. But we're in the green countryside now. The farmhouses are clean and white and fresh, and there's no smoke or smog. Chapter 2 The road winds on and on. We stop for rests and lunch, exchange small talk, settle down to the long ride. The beginning fatigue of afternoon balances the excitement of the first day, and we move steadily, not fast, not slow. We have picked up a southwest side wind, and the cycle cants into the gusts, seemingly by itself, to counter their effect. Lately there's been a sense of something peculiar about this road, apprehension about something, as if we were being watched or followed. But there is not a car anywhere ahead, and in the mirror are only John and Sylvia way behind. We are not in the Dakotas yet, but the broad fields show we are getting nearer. Some of them are blue with flax blossoms, moving in long waves like the surface of the ocean. The sweep of the hills is greater than before, and they now dominate everything else except the sky, which seems wider. Farmhouses in the distance are so small we can hardly see them. The land is beginning to open up. There is no one place or sharp line where the central plains end and the great plains begin. It's a gradual change like this that catches you unawares, as if you were sailing out from a choppy coastal harbor, noticed that the waves had taken on a deep swell, and turned back to see that you were out of sight of land. There are fewer trees here, and suddenly I am aware they are no longer native. They have been brought here and planted around houses and between fields in rows to break up the wind. But where they haven't been planted, there is no underbrush, no second-growth saplings, only grass, sometimes with wildflowers and weeds, but mostly grass. This is grassland now. We are on the prairie. I have a feeling none of us fully understands what 4 days on this prairie in July will be like. Memories of car trips across them are always of flatness and great emptiness as far as you can see. Extreme monotony and boredom as you drive for hour after hour, getting nowhere, wondering how long this is going to last without a turn in the road, without a change in the land, going on and on to the horizon. John was worried Sylvia would not be up to the discomfort of this, and planned to have her fly to Billings, Montana, but Sylvia and I both talked him out of it. I argued that physical discomfort is important only when the mood is wrong. Then you fasten on to whatever thing is uncomfortable and call that the cause. But if the mood is right, then physical discomfort doesn't mean much. And when thinking about Sylvia's moods and feelings, I couldn't see her complaining. Also, to arrive in the Rocky Mountains by plane would be to see them in one kind of context, as pretty scenery. But to arrive after days of hard travel across the prairies would be to see them in another way, as a goal, a promised land. If John and I and Chris arrived with this feeling, and Sylvia arrived seeing them as nice and pretty, there would be more disharmony among us than we would get from the heat and monotony of the Dakotas. Anyway, I like to talk to her, and I'm thinking of myself, too. In my mind, when I look at these fields, I say to her, "See? See?" And I think she does. I hope later she will see and feel a thing about these prairies I've given up talking to others about. A thing that exists here because everything else does not, and can be noticed because other things are absent. She seems so depressed sometimes by the monotony and boredom of her city life, I thought maybe in this endless grass and wind, she would see a thing that sometimes comes when monotony and boredom are accepted. It's here, but I have no names for it. Now on the horizon, I see something else I don't think the others see. Far off to the southwest, you can see it only from the top of this hill. The sky has a dark edge. Storm coming. That may be what has been bothering me. Deliberately shutting it out of mind, but knowing all along that with this humidity and wind, it was more than likely. It's too bad on the first day, but as I said before, on a cycle you're in the scene, not just watching it, and storms are definitely part of it. If it's just thunderheads or broken-line squalls, you can try to ride around them, but this one isn't. That long dark streak, without any preceding cirrus clouds, is a cold front. Cold fronts are violent, and when they are from the southwest, they are the most violent. Often they contain tornadoes. When they come, it's best to just hole up and let them pass over. They don't last long, and the cool air behind them makes good riding. Warm fronts are the worst. They can last for days. I remember Chris and I were on a trip to Canada a few years ago, got about 130 miles, and were caught in a warm front of which we had plenty of warning, but which we didn't understand. The whole experience was kind of dumb and sad. We were on a little 6 1/2 horsepower cycle, way overloaded with luggage and way underloaded with common sense. The machine could do only about 45 miles per hour wide open against a moderate headwind. It was no touring bike. We reached a large lake in the North Woods the first night and tented amid rainstorms that lasted all night long. I forgot to dig a trench around the tent, and at about 2 a.m. a stream of water came in and soaked both sleeping bags. The next morning we were soggy and depressed and hadn't had much sleep. But I thought that if we just got riding, the rain would let up after a while. No such luck. By 10 o'clock the sky was so dark all the cars had their headlights on. And then it really came down. We were wearing the ponchos which had served as a tent the night before. Now they spread out like sails and slowed our speed to 30 miles an hour wide open. The water on the road became 2 inches deep. Lightning bolts came crashing down all around us. I remember a woman's face looking astonished at us from the window of a passing car, wondering what on earth we were doing on a motorcycle in this weather. I'm sure I couldn't have told her. The cycle slowed down to 25, then 20. Then it started missing, coughing and popping and sputtering until, barely moving at 5 or 6 miles an hour, we found an old run-down filling station by some cutover timberland and pulled in. At the time, like John, I hadn't bothered to learn much about motorcycle maintenance. I remember holding my poncho over my head to keep the rain from the tank and rocking the cycle between my legs. Gas seemed to be sloshing around inside. I looked at the plugs, and looked at the points, and looked at the carburetor, and pumped the kickstarter until I was exhausted. We went into the filling station, which was also a combination beer joint and restaurant, and had a meal of burned-up steak. Then I went back out and tried it again. Chris kept asking questions that started to anger me because he didn't see how serious it was. Finally, I saw it was no use, gave it up, and my anger at him disappeared. I explained to him as carefully as I could that it was all over. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by Robert M. Pirsig. Continued. Cassette 1, Side 2. I explained to him, as carefully as I could, that it was all over. We weren't going anywhere by cycle on this vacation. Chris suggested things to do like check the gas, which I had done, and find a mechanic. But there weren't any mechanics. Just cut over pine trees and brush and rain. I sat in the grass with him at the shoulder of the road, defeated, staring into the trees and underbrush. I answered all of Chris's questions patiently, and in time they became fewer and fewer. And then Chris finally understood that our cycle trip was really over, and began to cry. He was 8 then, I think. We hitchhiked back to our own city and rented a trailer and put it on our car, and came up and got the cycle and hauled it back to our own city, and then started out all over again by car. But it wasn't the same, and we didn't really enjoy ourselves much. 2 weeks after the vacation was over, one evening after work, I removed the carburetor to see what was wrong, but still couldn't find anything. To clean off the grease before replacing it, I turned the stopcock on the tank for a little gas. Nothing came out. The tank was out of gas. I couldn't believe it. I can still hardly believe it. I have kicked myself mentally 100 times for that stupidity, and don't think I'll ever really, finally get over it. Evidently, what I saw sloshing around was gas in the reserve tank, which I had never turned on. I didn't check it carefully because I assumed the rain had caused the engine failure. I didn't understand then how foolish quick assumptions like that are. Now we are on a 28-horse machine, and I take the maintenance of it very seriously. All of a sudden, John passes me, his palm down, signaling a stop. We slow down and look for a place to pull off on the gravelly shoulder. The edge of the concrete is sharp and the gravel is loose, and I'm not a bit fond of this maneuver. Chris asks, "What are we stopping for?" "I think we missed our turn back there," John says. I look back and see nothing. "I didn't see any sign," I say. John shakes his head. "Big as a barn door." "Really?" He and Sylvia both nod. He leans over, studies my map, and points to where the turn was, and then to a freeway overpass beyond it. We've already crossed this freeway, he says. I think he is right. Embarrassing. Go back or go ahead, I ask. He thinks about it. Well, I guess there's really no reason to go back. All right, let's just go ahead. We'll get there one way or another. And now, tagging along behind them, I think, why should I do a thing like that? I hardly noticed the freeway. And just now I forgot to tell them about the storm. Things are getting a little unsettling. The storm cloud bank is larger now, but it is not moving in as fast as I thought it would. That's not so good. When they come in fast, they leave fast. When they come in slow like this, you can get stuck for quite a time. I remove a glove with my teeth, reach down, and feel the aluminum side cover of the engine. The temperature is fine. Too warm to leave my hand there, not so hot I get a burn. Nothing wrong there. On an air-cooled engine like this, extreme overheating can cause a seizure. This machine has had one, in fact, three of them. I check it from time to time the same way I would check a patient who has had a heart attack, even though it seems cured. In a seizure, the pistons expand from too much heat, become too big for the walls of the cylinders, seize them, melt to them sometimes, and lock the engine and rear wheel and start the whole cycle into a skid. The first time this one seized, my head was pitched over the front wheel and my passenger was almost on top of me. At about 30, it freed up again and started to run, but I pulled off the road and stopped to see what was wrong. All my passenger could think to say was, "What did you do that for?" I shrugged and was as puzzled as he was, and stood there with the cars whizzing by, just staring. The engine was so hot the air around it shimmered and we could feel the heat radiate. When I put a wet finger on it, it sizzled like a hot iron, and we rode home slowly with a new sound. A slap that meant the pistons no longer fit, and an overhaul was needed. I took this machine into a shop because I thought it wasn't important enough to justify getting into myself, having to learn all the complicated details and maybe having to order parts and special tools and all that time-dragging stuff, which I could get someone else to do in less time. Sort of John's attitude. The shop was a different scene from the ones I remembered. The mechanics, who had once all seemed like ancient veterans, now looked like children. A radio was going full blast and they were clowning around and talking and seemed not to notice me. When one of them finally came over, he barely listened to the piston slap before saying, "Oh yeah, Tappets." Tappets? I should have known then what was coming. 2 weeks later, I paid their bill for $140, rode the cycle carefully at varying low speeds to wear it in, and then after 1,000 miles, opened it up. At about 75, it seized again and freed at 30, the same as before. When I brought it back, they accused me of not breaking it in properly, but after much argument, agreed to look into it. They overhauled it again, and this time took it out themselves for a high-speed road test. It seized on them this time. After the third overhaul 2 months later, they replaced the cylinders, put in oversized main carburetor jets, retarded the timing to make it run as coolly as possible, and told me, "Don't run it fast." It was covered with grease and did not start. I found the plugs were disconnected, connected them, and started it. And now there really was a Tappet noise. They hadn't adjusted them. I pointed this out, and the kid came with an open-end adjustable wrench, set wrong, and swiftly rounded both of the sheet aluminum Tappet covers, ruining both of them. "I hope we've got more of those in stock," he said. I nodded. He brought out a hammer and cold chisel and started to pound them loose. The chisel punched through the aluminum cover, and I could see he was pounding the chisel right into the engine head. On the next blow, he missed the chisel completely and struck the head with the hammer, breaking off a portion of two of the cooling fins. "Just stop," I said politely, feeling this was a bad dream. "Just give me some new covers and I'll take it the way it is." I got out of there as fast as possible. Noisy Tappets, shot Tappet covers, greasy machine, down the road, and then felt a bad vibration at speeds over 20. At the curb, I discovered two of the four engine mounting bolts were missing, and a nut was missing from the third. The whole engine was hanging on by only one bolt. The overhead cam chain tensioner bolt was also missing, meaning it would have been hopeless to try to adjust the Tappets anyway. Nightmare. The thought of John putting his BMW into the hands of one of those people is something I have never brought up with him. Maybe I should. I found the cause of the seizures a few weeks later, waiting to happen again. It was a little 25-cent pin in the internal oil delivery system that had been sheared and was preventing oil from reaching the head at high speeds. The question, why, comes back again and again, and has become a major reason for wanting to deliver this Chautauqua. Why did they butcher it so? These were not people running away from technology, like John and Sylvia. These were the technologists themselves. They sat down to do a job, and they performed it like chimpanzees. Nothing personal in it. There was no obvious reason for it. And I tried to think back into that shop, that nightmare place, to try to remember anything that could have been the cause. The radio was a clue. You can't really think hard about what you're doing and listen to the radio at the same time. Maybe they didn't see their job as having anything to do with hard thought, just wrench twiddling. If you can twiddle wrenches while listening to the radio, that's more enjoyable. Their speed was another clue. They were really slopping things around in a hurry and not looking where they slopped them. More money that way, if you don't stop to think that it usually takes longer or comes out worse. But the biggest clue seemed to be their expressions. They were hard to explain. Good-natured, friendly, easygoing, and uninvolved. They were like spectators. You had the feeling they had just wandered in there themselves, and somebody had handed them a wrench. There was no identification with the job. No saying, "I'm a mechanic." At 5 p.m., or whenever their 8 hours were in, you knew they would cut it off and not have another thought about their work. They were already trying not to have any thoughts about their work on the job. In their own way, they were achieving the same thing John and Sylvia were, living with technology without really having anything to do with it. Or rather, they had something to do with it, but their own selves were outside of it, detached, removed. They were involved in it, but not in such a way as to care. Not only did these mechanics not find that sheared pin, but it was clearly a mechanic who had sheared it in the first place, by assembling the side cover plate improperly. I remember the previous owner had said a mechanic had told him the plate was hard to get on. That was why. The shop manual had warned about this, but like the others, he was probably in too much of a hurry, or he didn't care. While at work, I was thinking about this same lack of care in the digital computer manuals I was editing. Writing and editing technical manuals is what I do for a living the other 11 months of the year, and I knew they were full of errors, ambiguities, omissions, and information so completely screwed up, you had to read them 6 times to make any sense out of them. But what struck me for the first time was the agreement of these manuals with the spectator attitude I had seen in the shop. These were spectator manuals. It was built into the format of them. Implicit in every line is the idea that here is the machine, isolated in time and in space from everything else in the universe. It has no relationship to you, you have no relationship to it. Other than to turn certain switches, maintain voltage levels, check for error conditions, and so on. That's it. The mechanics, in their attitude toward the machine, were really taking no different attitude from the manuals toward the machine, or from the attitude I had when I brought it in there. We were all spectators. And it occurred to me, there is no manual that deals with the real business of motorcycle maintenance, the most important aspect of all. Caring about what you are doing is considered either unimportant or taken for granted. On this trip, I think we should notice it, explore it a little, to see if in that strange separation of what man is from what man does, we may have some clues as to what the hell has gone wrong in this 20th century. I don't want to hurry it. That itself is a poisonous 20th century attitude. When you want to hurry something, that means you no longer care about it and want to get on to other things. I just want to get at it slowly, but carefully and thoroughly, with the same attitude I remember was present just before I found that sheared pin. It was that attitude that found it, nothing else. I suddenly noticed the land here is flattened into a Euclidean plain. Not a hill, not a bump anywhere. This means we have entered the Red River Valley. We will soon be in the Dakotas. Chapter 3. By the time we are out of the Red River Valley, the storm clouds are everywhere and almost upon us. John and I have discussed the situation in Breckenridge, and decided to keep going until we have to stop. That shouldn't be long now. The sun is gone, the wind is blowing cold, and a wall of differing shades of gray looms around us. It seems huge, overpowering. The prairie here is huge, but above it the hugeness of this ominous gray mass ready to descend is frightening. We are traveling at its mercy now. When and where it will come is nothing we can control. All we can do is watch it move in closer and closer. Where the darkest gray has come down to the ground, a town that was seen earlier, some small buildings and a water tower, has disappeared. It will be on us soon now. I don't see any towns ahead, and we are just going to have to run for it. I pull up alongside John and throw my hand ahead in a speed-up gesture. He nods and opens up. I let him get a little ahead, then pick up to his speed. The engine responds beautifully. 70, 80, 85. We are really feeling the wind now, and I drop my head to cut down the resistance. 90. The speedometer needle swings back and forth, but the tack reads a steady 9,000, about 95 miles an hour. And we hold this speed, moving. Too fast to focus on the shoulder of the road now. I reach forward and flip the headlight switch just for safety. But it is needed anyway. It is getting very dark. We whiz through the flat open land, not a car anywhere, hardly a tree. But the road is smooth and clean, and the engine now has a packed, high RPM sound that says it's right on. It gets darker and darker. A flash and kwam of thunder, one right on top of the other. That shook me, and Chris has got his head against my back now. A few warning drops of rain. At this speed, they are like needles. A second flash wham, and everything brilliant. And then in the brilliance of the next flash, that farmhouse, that windmill. Oh my God, he's been here. Throttle off. This is his road. A fence and trees. And the speed drops to 70, then 60, then 55, and I hold it there. Why are we slowing down? Chris shouts. Too fast. No, it isn't. I nod yes. The house and water tower have gone by, and then a small drainage ditch appears and a crossroad leading off to the horizon. Yes, that's right, I think. That's exactly right. They're way ahead of us, Chris hollers. Speed up! I turn my head from side to side. Why not? He hollers. Not safe. They're gone. They'll wait. Speed up! No. I shake my head. It's just a feeling. On a cycle, you trust them, and we stay at 55. The first rain begins now, but up ahead I see the lights of a town. I knew it would be there. When we arrive, John and Sylvia are there under the first tree by the road waiting for us. What happened to you? Slowed down. Well, we know that. Something wrong? No. Let's get out of this rain. John says there is a motel at the other end of town, but I tell him there's a better one if you turn right at a row of cottonwoods a few blocks down. We turn at the cottonwoods and travel a few blocks, and a small motel appears. Inside the office, John looks around and says, "This is a good place. When were you here before?" "I don't remember," I say. "Then how did you know about this?" "Intuition." He looks at Sylvia and shakes his head. Sylvia has been watching me silently for some time. She notices my hands are unsteady as I sign in. "You look awfully pale," she says. "Did that lightning shake you up?" "No." "You look like you've seen a ghost." John and Chris look at me, and I turn away from them to the door. It is still raining hard, but we make a run for it to the rooms. The gear on the cycles is protected, and we wait until the storm passes over before removing it. After the rain stops, the sky lightens a little. But from the motel courtyard, I see past the cottonwoods that a second darkness, that of night, is about to come on. We walk into town, have supper, and by the time we get back, the fatigue of the day is really on me. We rest, almost motionless in the metal armchairs of the motel courtyard, slowly working down a pint of whiskey that John brought with some mix from the motel cooler. It goes down slowly and agreeably. A cool night wind rattles the leaves of the cottonwoods along the road. Chris wonders what we should do next. Nothing tires this kid. The newness and strangeness of the motel surroundings excite him, and he wants us to sing songs as they did at camp.